So today we're going to be just kind of going through what the process is for designing monsters for us, talking about some of our... I'm going to sit down. I just wanted to
kick,
just to kind of go through the various processes we go through, talk about where we get inspiration from, and give you guys the chance to pick out one of a classic D&D monster that we'll then sort of go through and adapt to 4th edition, talking about what sort of changes we might make, what sort of, but what parts of the legacy we would want to preserve. So to kind of jump right into things, I guess I have to put it that. Finding inspiration. So, I'm going to put you guys on the spot, and where would you say that you find your inspiration when designing monsters, Mike?
So I would say right now, especially, I'm reading this big, thick collection of Clark Ashton Smith stories, and I am shamelessly stealing from him because he's brilliant and great, and you just read something like, it's really interesting experiencing a monster like in a story or movie, because it kind of gives you that visceral punch of what's really scary about this thing, and you just translate that, a lot of it translated into D&D. Now I try not to just write down word for word, I don't want to get fired for plagiarism. It gives you some ideas for like, hey, this is kind of cool. One of my favorite examples, it's an old dungeon adventure called Jacob's Well, where someone had just watched Alien and said, hey, a slod, when it plants a seed in somebody, it's kind of like an alien bursting out of someone's chest. They took a very familiar monster and gave it this really interesting spin of you're playing through Alien starring a slod as the alien. That's kind of something similar, a little bit different than the presentation was supposed to be a monster. But for me, it's all about that visceral, interesting feel of what is interesting about this monster, especially in play, in terms of the story.
I would say something similar as far as story goes. If the monster has a really interesting name and a history, and slots certainly do, then you're on your way. I often get inspiration for monsters from just interesting words that I'll hear. Like recently I heard this word in some completely other context, cryptobiotic. It turns out that is something, you know, that basically brings its life processes down to zero while it hibernates essentially. But I like the word cryptobiotic. It's like, wow, that just sounds, you know, cryptic, of course. And, you know, so I was like, my next monster is going to have something to do with cryptobiotic and the temporary cessation of life forces. And from there, it's like, wow, that sounds interesting. What's that monster going to be? Well, I don't know yet, but that's my current inspiration for a monster.
Mm-hmm. I think you find inspiration from a lot of different sources. It can be literature. It can be a word. Classic myth, of course, is rife with inspiration. And we certainly capitalize on a lot of Greek myths, having things like Pegasi, Hydras, but you know, there's other stuff out there. I've got Scylla up there, which is not something we've ever done, I think, as a at least 4th edition monster. But the you can take different components of those monsters, mix and match them, and create a monster that maybe resonates with your players because they've seen it in movies, or one example that I particularly liked was in Hellboy 2, the sort of primordial life creature that starts as a seed and then becomes this huge elder entity. It reminded me a lot of a primordial, and one of the nice things about picking up monsters from movies is that you already have sort of an image in your head, and then you can assign powers, traits, characteristics based on how you want to represent that.
That monster in particular was an inspiration for one of the primordials in the adventure Chris Sims and I wrote, the first of the epic tier, whose name escapes me. But
Death's Reach.
That Chris Sims really liked that as well, and that was the inspiration.
Mm-hmm. Video games. I mean, there's so many video games now. I thought it would be a little bit of a cliche to put the World of Warcraft, but obviously it has a lot of monsters. I picked God of War because I particularly liked this huge sort of nightmare-like horse that you can just imagine your villain stampeding across the PCs with it. And then, of course, something that I'm sure many of us are familiar with is comic books. I find comic books are a great resource for villains because usually comic books have something to give a monster depth. It's not just, you know, something that the PCs are going to hack through and kill. You can borrow the idea of a villain having certain redeemable traits and use that to create a monster, a villain that's going to recur throughout your campaign.
The hardest thing with inspiration is really, well, not the hardest thing. Probably the most fun thing about inspiration, it's not the hardest, it's the easiest. It's really just about keeping yourself exposed to new ideas and new media. You know, seeking out new authors, watching new movies. I mean, really, it's just about, if you kind of always have this eye open for things you can steal or be inspired by, you know, it turns any movie you watch, any book you watch, into something that's going to feed your creativity. I mean, I read this sort of interesting article recently about how the root of creativity is taking two unlinked elements and finding a link to them. You know, it's really just saying, hey, no one ever thought of this, looked at this element this way before. There was a good example in MM3, one of the freelancers, I think it was Matt Getz, but I might be wrong. There was a Minotaur entry. And so you could just do Minotaurs, like, well, here's a Minotaur Berserker and here's a Minotaur Pirate. But he instead looked at the idea of the Minotaur in the labyrinth and said, hey, why do Minotaurs want creatures to go into their labyrinth? What's interesting about that? He came up with a story about, okay, this group of Minotaurs, they lure magical creatures into their labyrinth. They want them to get lost because that's part of this ritual they use. They're, once a creature has lost all hope or something, I can't remember the full detail I might be adding to it, but they kill it, they eat its heart, and then they gain its power. So instead of just having a Minotaur Berserker, you have a Minotaur that's a Minotaur with a vampire's traits, a Minotaur with a unicorn's traits, a Minotaur with the nightmare's traits. You know, here are creatures of this cult of Minotaurs dedicated to Baphomet, have defeated and devoured, and now they've stolen their power. So it's not just a typical Minotaur, it's playing on that familiar myth, but it's adding a twist to it that's unique. It also says something about Minotaur, like the culture of this monster in your world, how they fit in, why they do this very classic element. And the great thing about something like that is if you have someone who's never really played D&D before, doesn't have much experience, they probably understand, though, a Minotaur in a labyrinth, that's just like a classic Greek myth. They probably had some exposure to that. A lot of the details of that story have already clicked into place. You as a DM or as a writer are only explaining to them that one twist that makes it a little bit different and locks everything into place. And I think that's a very useful thing is, you know, it's very easy to just create, you know, it's like something out of South Park, right? You know, it's a pig with, you know, five heads and 10 tails and it breathes acid. Like, you can just rattle off random traits, but it's tying those all together in a neat, interesting, compelling package. That's really the challenge, where everything hangs together really well.
Yeah, I like what you say about adding a twist, because I think it's, you know, there's enough monsters out there that you can fill your game with just about anything. But I think the creatures that end up really resonating with players are those that, you know, that don't do quite what they expect or don't act quite as they would expect.
The Minotaur example is good too, because think of like the idea of eating someone's heart to gain their power. I mean, if you've read Stardust or seen the movie, that happens, and that's an element of it. It's another common mythological trope of how you might steal something's power. None of that is alien or weird to the players, but it's just maybe combining a way they haven't seen before.
And just giving the monster a motivation that they're not expecting will make them go, oh, take note. I think it's really important.
Yeah,
lead them down the path, and it's not exactly what that was at the other end.
Exactly. Yeah, and if there are one final thing about that story that I like, it sets up a good adventure. Maybe the Minotaurs have targeted one of the players. They want to kill this, you know, the party's paladin. They want to defeat him and steal his power. So that's why the Minotaurs, you know, whatever, lure the characters into the labyrinth. Or there's a reason why the villain has arranged it, or the story, you know, that's why you're going in here. The players maybe don't realize it up front. But it ties everything together into your campaign to a cohesive whole. Everything makes sense.
Another way that you can create monsters is looking at what's been done before and adding that twist. As part of this presentation, I got the idea that it would be sort of fun to find some older classic monsters from early D&D books, and then have you guys decide what you want us to adapt and make into something 4th edition. I asked for a few ideas on Twitter, found a few of my own, and so I'm actually just going to, by kind of a show of hands, see what you want us to look at, and then we'll kind of just improvise from there. So You can vote for multiples if you want, but Pixies. Anyone? Pixies? No Pixie takers. All right. the Morcott. Some, and if you haven't played D&D, don't you know, the classic versions of D&D, you don't, and haven't heard of some of these, don't worry. So there's a couple of votes for the Morcott. Thought Eater.
That's the duck thing.
Yeah, yeah, the duck thing, yeah. There may be reasons that these weren't adapted to the fourth edition, but we're not going to worry about that. We're going to see how we can make even the wackiest creatures cool. So it looked like, I think I saw three for the Thought Eater. The Frog Hemoth. You Frog Hemoth fans in there, I think four
three,
there.
Yeah. Berry Peaks.
Zag-Ya and Zeg-Yi.
Those are the energy.
Yep, the inner kind of
positive
balls of energy.
Positive
few there, three, four. Modrons. I wondered about that.
People like Modrons, huh? Interesting.
And Kelpies?
No.
No. Oh, the Kelpies. Necrophidius. That's like a skeletal snake with a skull on it. There's more. And the Vadianai?
I think you could have just put
aquatic
Modron.
Yeah, I thought that one would be kind of a shoo-in, but... all right, so let's look at some of the classic material from the Modron.
You guys picked it.
This is interesting because you look at this art and you're like, oh, it looks a little weird, but then the Planescape art, I forget, it was, I don't know if Dietro Lizzi did that art, but like the Great Modron March, I think they look awesome on that cover. They look really cool because it makes them these kind of clockwork guys instead of just, oh, it's a cube with arms and legs. Okay, that's, you know, the art director was kind of feeling sick that day. But, so I just want to throw that in. This is something where a detail can make all the difference. It's easy to look at this creature, and obviously a lot of people like Modrons, and they like when they first came out, but you could look at this and go, hey, you know, there's not really much going on here, but then you think of the Planescape representation, which is, I don't know if you have a picture of that in here, far more flavorful. And it adds a lot of nice visual detail to it, makes it, okay, this is why these guys are interesting. There's, like that almost, and I might be scrambling the picture, correct me if I'm wrong, but they also have like this kind of clockwork thing where the guy with the one eye has like this lens that can drop down, and it kind of makes you start thinking, what's this guy's culture like? They're in this weird clockwork, oh, because they live in, oh my god, I'm forgetting the name, Lawful Neutral Plane.
Plane of Nirvana is from the original, but I don't know what it's...
Mechanics.
Mechanics. Oh yeah, in,
you know,
in later...
It hints at a story beyond, it's a cube with arms, legs, and wings, you know, which I think is just more inherently interesting.
So what would you guys, Bruce or Mike, say that is kind of at the core idea of the Modron? And where would you start in trying to adapt something like this to 4th edition?
Well, this isn't fair to Bruce, because having worked on M3, you know where I stand.
I know.
So why don't we start, should I start?
Yeah, with? No, we'll start with Bruce.
I have like an entire essay.
Well, I think that the original... The core concept of the Modron was, you know, a physical manifestation, a living manifestation of the cosmological principle of law in the world, the D&D verse. I don't know if that's a strong enough, if that is something we would want to go forward with in 4th edition, because it seems just in and of itself a kind of a limiting idea, perhaps, maybe not. But I would say that's probably the core principle of Modrons, is that they are manifestations of a cosmic principle of order. Maybe you could turn it on its head and say they're not necessarily the manifestation of order, but they're a manifestation of the fight against entropy as an idea.
Is there anyone here who doesn't know the full story behind the Modrons and how they're... So essentially the Modrons in first edition and second edition, their power range from like the weakest one had one side, a sphere. If you had like three sides, four sides, essentially your dice, you can think of. The more sides they had, the more powerful they were. And I think, I forget, Primus was just a humanoid.
Humanoid, yeah. The ultimate power of the Modrons.
So they had this very orderly society. Everything was locked in. So if you've read Flatland, it's a little bit like that.
So I think that, even though, Bruce, you mentioned the sort of lawful characteristic of that, and, you know, when you mentioned fighting against entropy, I think that can be a really compelling hook, especially because we have creatures like Slads that are creatures of chaos. And so when I start to look at sort of the core concept of a monster, I start to sort of build those connections, maybe starting to think about where it fits in the D&D universe or in my game's universe, And what other factions might be opposing or with that creature group, as well as how that's going to fit into with the creature with respect to the players. Whether this is going to be something, I mean, you want, if you're designing a monster, most of the time you're going to want it to oppose the PCs in some way, but you want that to be compelling. You don't want this to just be a creature that doesn't.
I was just going to say, so that's leading me down a storyline. You know, the Modrons, you know, if they're opposing chaos and opposing, if they want to preserve the natural world, perhaps anytime there's some sort of like, you know, dimensional portal or something like that, they look at that as a weakening or a rift. And Modrons, you might find them, you know, preventing people like PCs from trying to access portals. And they're like, oh yes, we're going to step over to the shadow plane through this rift. And they're like, suddenly Modrons have been, you know, starting to get more and more concerned about the more and more portals and stuff in the D&D multiverse, and so perhaps they're starting to spread out, and PCs are starting to come into contact with them more and more. At first, in this, just of like, wow, there's weird Modrons here, you know, contesting our passage through this portal, but, you know, later on, you could find out it's a much more involved storyline, you know, that goes towards an epic level sort of plotline.
The nice thing about a story like that, too, is it's very easy to scale it up and down. It could be like, well, okay, the Modrons are like this cosmic, they see themselves as cosmic police force. They don't want any creature leaving one plane and going to another. That's what they fight against. You could cast them as very, very much just antagonists. You're in a plane-hopping campaign, these guys are just trying to stop you. A DM can twist it and say, actually, it turns out the Modrons are right. Every time creatures travel between the planes, they're weakening the cosmic firmament. This is actually dangerous. These guys are right all along, that kind of thing. With a good story that the DM can mold in a couple different ways, you give a lot of flexibility, and even within the campaign, you can have like the range of Modrons. Like, these Modrons are the real extremists, you know, these are the more reasonable ones. If you think of like the rogue Modrons in Planescape, you know, I think there's one in Planescape Torment, if I remember right,
yeah.
You can meet a Modron that could join your party. And I think just things where, if you look at a monster, there are sometimes just monstrous monsters, but having a monster that can be an NPC you talk with or an enemy you fight just gives the DM more story options, and I think breathes more life into it. It's more than just a cardboard cutout that you're just knocking over on your way to your next pile of XP. It gives you more of a narrative to your campaign, and it lets the DM pick out a few key monster groups when you're building your campaign and see, okay, these are the big stories in my campaign world. You know, this is a campaign world where the Modrons have stopped all planar travel, so there's no divine magic because no one even knows the gods exist anymore. You know, all magical power is really reduced because no one's gone to other planes or planar creatures, and maybe that's the turning point of the campaign where, okay, now something is starting to break through. Well, the Modrons have disappeared. What's going on? You know, it helps build into the world. Like, one of the things we did in MM3 that I wanted the freelancers to do was write some text about the monster that doesn't assume, that assumes it has a place other than being XP fodder. Like, what does this creature do in the world when it's not fighting the characters? You know, what is its role in the grand scheme of things?
And it can be a challenge when you're talking about things that are, you know, sort of beastly. Like, we picked the frog hemoth, which is sort of just a large tentacled frog, but you can build a compelling story even for those type of creatures, even if it's you know, just that this creature lives in swamps, but you know, is good. A lack of inspiration here, but
cryptobiotic.
But
if you think of the original story, I think they first showed up in Expedition to the Barrier Peaks, which we haven't played the module and are planning on, it's current years, because spoiler time.
La, 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 la.
Yeah, it's a dungeon that's set in a spaceship. Like, you don't realize it, that it's a spaceship that's crashed in hundreds of thousands of years ago. It's been covered by a rock slide. You think you're going into a dungeon, it turns out to be the interior of a spaceship. And maybe that's the sort of weird story of, you know, hey, it's a strange creature that suddenly shows up and looks like nothing else in the swamp. Maybe you can pull in, like, some sort of modern storylines. It's you know, it's annihilating every other creature in the swamp. There's, you know, you start fighting the lizardmen who are fleeing from this thing. You finally find it, you kill it. It's like nothing of this world. Okay, that's pointing to like the big story in your campaign. There's this crashed spaceship that's opened up and monsters are coming out. That's going to be the weird world-changing event the players have to do.
Portal to the Far Realm.
Yeah.
They start finding other aberrants. But you can take even a pretty simple beast of a creature and start wrapping story around it and, you know, making even the mundane monsters be interesting. And also, that makes it a lot more enjoyable just to read about that type of monster. One of the things that we did in Monster Manual 3 and are continuing to do with things like Monster Vault is to try to, in placing that creature within the world, make these monsters just enjoyable to read about, 'cause even if you're not using them in your campaign, because it actually fills in some of the details. Maybe one creature doesn't show up in a campaign, but it kind of hints at something else, provides a little inspiration, and the DM ends up using that as a hook for some other adventure completely unrelated to that monster. So for the Modrons, we could have something like they are collapsing portals, or that they are sort of directly opposite to the far realm, and that they come from a plane of absolute order, and the world or the D&D multiverse sort of exists between, and so they could instead be antagonists that are trying to establish order in the world by breaking everything down, breaking matter down, and that could be another hook for them being monsters. But once you sort of establish what you want the monster's story to be, it becomes time to fill in some more of the details. So we've got to actually, I kind of got ahead of myself, we've sort of got a couple compelling stories that could provide the basis for that monster. Then what I like to think about is, I'm getting ahead of myself, it's something to unify the monsters in terms of mechanics. You don't always have to have this, but trying to think of a power or trait that somehow brings those creatures together.
So a trait that strikes me, an interesting trait a Modron might have if they're trying to, bring order, is to be some sort of a teleportational null space. Maybe Modrons, if you're next to the lower level ones, if you're adjacent to one, you can't use any power that has a teleport, keyword. The higher level ones maybe have a larger and larger sink. That could be an interesting thing that goes along with their story. They're trying to prevent, dimensional travel, but maybe even just teleportational travel is sort of a offshoot of that they might have.
Yeah, I was thinking of something where you might look at the Modrons, this idea of the hierarchy, like zero, one side on up. Maybe there's some sort of mechanic where a Modron of a higher rank can do things to the lower ranking ones. Sacrifice them to get a bonus, or there's some attack it can use and it can make the other smaller ones blow up or fuel it. Or if every time you hit the higher level one, it just drains hit points from the lower level ones, so it can survive. Things like that. So you get this very clear sense of you're fighting Modrons, kind of have
a hierarchy.
Yeah, there's a hierarchy. You start at the lower level ones as you fight them and then work your way up. Because if you just start hitting the tough guy, he's just draining all the life energy from the lower ranking guys so he can survive. And then the nice thing is then you just have one on up. You can just throw in some sort of keyword or mechanic or some new way to describe that so the DM can easily see the relationship between them.
One of the things I wanted to bring up, and the reason I've got the picture of the catastrophic dragon up there is, if you're creating monsters that are part of an existing creature group, what you can do to sort of make those more interesting or more compelling. With the catastrophics, we decided that we didn't want to do a typical breath weapon. We've got the chromatics, we've got the metallics, they all breathe, but what sort of twist could we put on that new monster group to make it break convention?
Yeah.
And where we landed was an aura that expands and is sort of this aura of disaster that they bring, and it still has sort of the same boom effect that a breath weapon does, but it is it makes these dragons feel distinct.
There are also other ways you can make things feel a little bit more distinct too that maybe speak to the world that aren't. They're mechanically driven, but not necessarily like in powers. Like, for example, these dragons are a good example because they're all elite. Up to this point, our full-grown dragons have all been solo. These guys are elites, and there's hints in the story of, well, these guys are the ones that survived the great war between the primordials and gods. But there are rumors of even more powerful catastrophe dragons of some weird type that made the entire firmament of the plains shake when they flew, and massive disasters that spanned entire worlds. And so it kind of leaves the question open, well, what maybe that's the solo version of this? We just haven't revealed it yet, or things like that. But it kind of explains, here's why these guys are, why they're elite and not solo. Very mechanical concept, but we then transfer it into a very strong, a story concept.
So continuing with the example of the Modrons, we've talked about this a little bit already, but then it sort of becomes time to fill in what I would say are sort of the maybe the non-mechanical details, but help you establish or to sort of funnel the story down into something that is can be used in play. So, you know, we talked about where the Modrons sound like a very planar creature. So, what sort of expectations then would we have for their origin and their type? Probably constructs.
Correct.
Living constructs seems reasonable.
Yeah,
I have some other ideas for powers that would make that really reasonable as well.
And what happens then when these guys die? Are they immortals? Are they just natural creatures? Probably not elemental, but I
think that's where like you kind of think of the story. Like, what's the relationship to the plane? I mean, maybe you say they are elemental because they were the original like elemental forces were unified.
Yeah.
The primordials, demons are actually a rebellion. They're the opposite of that. It used to be very earlier. It's been destroyed. They could be astral. You could say no. These guys were once the servants of a long forgotten god, or they arrived after the rift of the Far Realm opened, and these guys seem to arrive in response to it. You know, things like that. I think that's really driven by what you see as their place in the D&D cosmology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's actually interesting thinking about different origins as sort of a jumping off point. Like you were saying, if you did pick elemental, maybe Modrons were the elemental building blocks of the world, and that the primordials actually crushed them to help make matter in the world. There's a lot of interesting hooks that can come out of just sort of turning the knobs of the specifics in a stat block.
Maybe someone built the first primordial, and there's this big, huge, massive engine that was disassembled into all these individual creatures and that gained a life of their own, too. I mean, could have had an artificial creation way, way back in the day.
So you can see how even taking a creature that maybe on first glance is maybe doesn't look that cool, maybe has maybe doesn't have the most compatible story with fourth edition, and just by tweaking a few things, you can give rise to something that preserves the original intent of the monster, but creates a new place for it in the cosmology.
Yeah, and if we're doing this in-house, one of the things we do also do at this point, and this kind of gets inserted for publishing, probably go back and look at like some of the source books and say, okay, what was the story here? Like maybe we use like Mechanus as like, well, we use that and instead of introduce it, well, here's where Mechanus fits into our cosmology, things like that. I mean, when you're dealing with an existing monster, especially when you've been publishing, as opposed to for your own campaign, we have to kind of go back and make sure it's not. If we're changing it, we're changing it for a good reason. We're not changing it in a way that people read and go, why is this different? I don't really understand why this has been changed.
So to continue with the example of the Modrons, we've talked now how they kind of have maybe a hierarchy. And then it becomes interesting talking about how that might speak to the different roles. Like, are the smaller ones going to that have the ones that have only one side would be, if they were the weakest?
Yeah, yeah. Spheres.
So they would be like the minions, perhaps. And maybe as you'd have the sort of soldiers that represented the lower ranking ones, all, and maybe the brutes as well, all the way up to the controller, you could definitely see being the multi-sided Modron.
Yeah. Or he's a leader. Yeah,
yeah, or a leader.
And that's something, too, where with roles, I know when I design a creature, I tend to do the role, what's one of the last things I'll do? Because I like to get a good sense of what I want the creature to do to get the dramatic effect in the game, and then I'll think, okay, now where is this guy, where is it leading this guy? And I might say, okay, this guy is looking like he should be a skirmisher, then I'll kind of look back and make sure, okay, is he doing enough of this so he feels like a skirmisher, so I'm more tweaking things. But even when, like in this case, we're talking about kind of a race of monsters, even things like, does this race even have minions? That kind of tells you something about it. I could see, we could take the opposite attack and say, you know what, there aren't that many Modrons, they're a dwindling race. There's no such thing as a Modron minion, because the ones that have survived so far are the powerful ones, the ones that are left. On the other hand, you might take a race and say, we'll do like five or six different types of them to get started, and five of them are minions, because this is a race of slave drivers, or it's like a colony ant kind of thing, where they just use wave tactics and just they'll suffer 1,000 casualties to take down one guy. You know, so it's all just like one leader type maybe, and all these different types of minions that have different types of attacks.
One of the things that I find is that, and that I think you encouraged in Monster Manual 3 was to not really start to think about the specific powers until you really had a good story behind the monster. So in this case, now that we sort of have developed this, obviously this would be a much more long prolonged process if we were actually going to create the entire creature entry. And I know part of the goal of this seminar was that we're supposed to have a DDI article with whatever creature we end up doing.
Are you serious?
So, yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. One of the Lorians back in the game. You guys did it. Yes. Oh, sweet.
So we talked a little bit about what unified them. What do you guys think would then be maybe, let's work our way up and pick like, okay, so the one-sided mode run.
Yeah.
What would you see the sphere? What would you see it doing?
Well, what do you guys, anyone want to go?
Oh, actually, one of the things you were just saying with the simplest mode runs and the whole idea of order and structuring things, what if they were terrain effects? The simplest Modron would build a wall that the higher level Modrons would use to bounce powers around, or something along those lines.
Like a StarCraft II sort of thing, where you go, it kind of just becomes a terrain effect, and then it can come back up. That would be an interesting sort of very low level effect,
it's
especially for the minion sort of things where you're sending your people around.
It makes you picture almost like in 300 when Xerxes appears. He shows up on his throne. I almost picture like when the Modron Lord goes to sit down his throne, all these Modrons scurrying in and transforming to parts of the throne, they build it all up around him. Wherever he goes, his retinue just becomes his little palace that he sits in, and he starts haranguing the characters for, whatever their transgression against the planar alignment or the planar order,
Yeah, so like the spheres and the squares could just have a lot of specific trait effects, or maybe four squares could become like a large creature that would have a different, suddenly it would become a brood or something like that.
Like a big Voltron.
Yeah, I could see a power where maybe as a standard action, they can basically become, these inert blocking terrain. And so you could actually have, maybe if you did have a minion form, you could have these minions basically be able to form walls, like you were saying. And while they're in this form, they can't really be harmed very easily. But you could adapt the idea of... having terrain, they could build up a large tower for the other Modron to stand on. Or
you don't even need minis, just get Legos.
Yeah,
exactly.
The other thing you can do is when you get into the higher level, maybe Epic tier, or maybe even Paragon path, with the when you make a controller version of the Modron, I like the idea of like the gravity well effect where they try to fly, there's resistance to it. If you try to slide, teleport, anything, it stops and dead in its tracks, but also have the gravity wells effect where they can reverse it on a snap and really wreck up a player's day.
Yeah, that'd be interesting. A building the teleportation, you have like they start messing with all forms of movement.
Right.
They're all in order. You will move when we let you move.
Right.
We're going to control matter around us.
Yeah,
that'd be a cool theme.
They could have some ability to resist forced movement, or like you were saying, sort of bounce forced movement back on them. Whenever you slide them, they slide you.
Yeah, they don't get slid, instead they slide you. If you push them 5, they don't get pushed, instead they pull you 5.
They seem to be part of surfaces. When I think of surfaces, any type of flat surfaces, I think of reflections. And if you have more sides, if something hit can be shattered out in reflective surfaces. Has some possibility or in their defenses.
And that fits in pretty
like
well.
Like a trait that if the Modron, if a many-sided Modron gets hit with an attack, with like a ranged or an energy-based attack, the creatures around it take a little bit of damage because some of it bounces off
their
sides.
And that's kind of cool, this idea of turning the character's power against them. About these guys, they're exerting control. Is there any question?
To kind of go off what Dave was just saying, they could also hinge out the like blasts and bursts where they just cut it off or separate it or block it off so it's not... They could drop one Modron in the middle, and suddenly your burst 2 is cut straight down the middle, and you're not getting the Modron.
That'd be a really cool effect for a minion, where you can say, hey, if a minion gets hit by an area attack, it reduces the size of that area, that attack. And anything that's not in the area now doesn't get hit by the attack.
Especially if you do the whole marching ant thing, where you've got minions of Modrons out, the controllers or elites or solos can send out a minion to take the area burst instead of them taking it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Here's another crazy thought is you could actually have, if you wanted to do a solo or an elite, you could basically design it so that it splits. That if you had you had a large creature, when you bloodied it, it actually splits into 4 medium creatures. That could be a specific yeah, specifically for like an elite or a solo.
I like the idea of going into the idea of them being very soldier-like, almost army ant-like, that their movement would be slower, but then taking no movement penalty from difficult terrain.
Yeah,
they're always
march,
they
right,
move
yeah.
slowly, but it's really hard to stop them once they get on the march.
Yeah, like oh, are they really hard to immobilize? You know,
yeah,
you just immobilize as soon as you immobilize, are they get a check or something.
They get a saving throw at the start
to,
of their turn
to just
maybe.
Keep going.
Yeah,
or immobilize turns into a slow.
So those are all because you can kind of see how those disparate elements come together. Now you have a pretty cool vision of what these guys are like. We're talking a lot about their personality, right? These guys implacable. They control things. They turn powers against each other. They mess with what you do because they want to be in control. They are going to dictate what you can do. And what they want to do, good luck stopping it because they're just like a tidal wave coming at you.
If you ever get players into the epic tier against Modrons and you go against the king or leader, whatever you want to call it, you all were saying that the original one, I guess, Primus, I guess was the name, he was so multi-sided, he was basically like a humanoid. Another, because apparently I'm on an evil bent today. He's so multi-sided that damage that he incurs, he actually just slides it into a different portion of his body instead of taking the full damage himself.
Yeah, you could do something interesting where you sort of have to break him down by parts that
yeah.
you, we don't have really parts where you target.
So what you could do is you could have a number of attacks he's using, and as he just takes damage, those attacks start to go away. Like he's lost an arm now. He just transfers a little damage to an arm, he no longer gets his blade arm or something like that. Mm-hmm. Is there a question back?
Some kind of sounds like you're making the Modrons asteroids. You know, as you hit them, they break apart. Into
yeah,
I
guess.
You have to kill all the minions at the end.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's actually, it creates a really interesting combat scenario where you're actually, and we did talk about you could had to kill the small ones to get up to the big ones, but you could also go the other way where
yeah.
it's actually the minions for once that survive the longest.
And that's a good idea too, because we have a lot of ideas floating around, and maybe you suddenly say, okay, we have all these ideas, let's just try to put one idea per creature, you know, where we don't want to try to do everything all at once. So, and minions are great for that, because minions are pretty easy to track at the table. So yeah, I like the idea, like this minion, whenever you move, he just moves with you. Or almost acting like a terrain effect, where it's like, okay, you can't shift while you're adjacent to this minion. Or, you know, you're slowed if you end your turn next to it, things like that.
One of the things that strikes me about this conversation is that it seems as though all of them are kind of a secondary role as controller, despite whatever their primary role
yeah.
would be.
Yeah.
And we do have secondary roles in classes, and I think that to some extent we have that in Monsters too, even if we don't call that out. And these guys definitely seem like they would all be a little controller.
You were talking earlier about having maybe at the end all that's left is just the minions. I kind of like the old chestnut where the leader, the elite leader, has 4, 5, 6 minions around them, and instead of taking damage, you just sort of you die. You know, as one of them jumps in front of him. No, sir, look out.
Well,
yeah.
The kind of neat thing about the mechanic, I think they actually work very well together, where if you fight 4 big ones, you break one down to minions, and now these 3 guys are using the minions that were just created.
Yeah, they could. When you hit them, they can instead pop one of their minions or
yeah,
something
like
that.
Which came out of
like
the cube that you just broke down to 4 spheres, or whatever, the giant triangle that goes down to 4 smaller triangles, or however you want to work it.
Yeah.
It might be kind of interesting, you work into the story saying, actually, when you kill it, you're not killing it, you're causing it to scorporate and change shape, because Primus is angry with them. Like, how dare you be defeated? Modrons are placable. You go from being a cube to being a rectangle,
right.
a triangle.
You've been demoted
yeah.
to a lesser
yeah.
polyhedron.
But that's a good way to take a mechanic you usually see one way and then make it feel a lot different when you apply it to this kind of creature.
Yeah, you could have actually have a huge swarm, but it actually consisted of, you know, 9 Modrons or something that were all kind of cluttered together. One of the things I think that, like you were saying, the swarm is often taken as just to describe small creatures,
yeah,
but
swarm of bees,
you get very
bees.
Interesting things. I think there's a huge huge swarm of orcs in one product where, you know, that it's basically just this group of 20 orcs all crammed
yeah.
into one space.
It's a zombie swarm somewhere.
A zombie
yeah.
swarm, yeah.
I've used
as I'm listening to you talk, you're sounding like your swarm is all melee. Does the Modrum have any range effect? I mean, does he shoot arrows? Does he shoot rays? I just hear this march of
yeah. That's a good question.
Muscle.
And
do
that's another area too, where
yeah.
you can say a lot about the creature and how it feels by saying we could say no, or we could say yes. I mean, that's and maybe if we say no, that
or
says a lot.
Or maybe only yes for the 20-sided guy.
Yeah, exactly. Like one of the most powerful ones. Because again, that's something where you're kind of revealing something about the creature's culture and when they're fighting it, of, hey, like if the, you can think of the adventure where you're fighting Modrons, suddenly you have a Modron who's using a ranged power and maybe an attack blasting with a laser beam. Oh, that means something. Oh, these guys are really deadly. Those are the worst guys to fight because, you know, most of the drones are just attacking in close range.
I was just going to say, it seems like, yeah, you wouldn't necessarily have lasers or something like that, but if you were a Modron, you would probably have some sort of bombardier attack cannon where you actually shoot minions that fall amidst and do a burst. I do a burst and either create a train or create a swarm or something like that. You're actually shooting minions.
And that kind of ties into this idea. Maybe it's only the high ranking guys that are doing this because they're basically just sending the
shots. They can even just shoot
right
out of their body, the high levels. Like
Or their ranged attack is actually just a slide effect. They push one of their allies, you know, 10 squares, and then that ally gets to make a basic attack, or, you know, you're making the.
It takes some damage. And the guy takes some damage.
Yeah, exactly.
Or another thought you could do is with the minions, probably do like a ping pong effect, where if they hit with a specific power, they can ricochet, if you've got enough Modrons in a certain area, bounce them from each Modron and then taking damage.
Yeah, so it encourages, and that's another great thing. What I like about mechanics like that is it makes the players approach things differently, but it also immerses them in the game. It immerses them in the fiction of the world. They see, hey, this is what just happened. It's not just a pure mechanic thing like take 10 damage. It's you bounced off these Modrons, they pushed you around. Okay, well, let's kill that guy quick so the next guy doesn't get knocked around.
And so one of the other things I wanted to talk about, and we'll open up the questions in a little while, but is adapting monsters, because I think that if you're an experienced DM, you probably know it's really easy with 4th edition monsters to basically just take a stat block and reskin it. You know, change a few damage types, and change the name, maybe alter a few powers, and then you've got a very different monster. Do either of you have any interesting experiences adapting monsters?
I think the most interesting one was probably, this might be before we released the game, so I'd be like making no sense. I had a water elemental that I wanted to be just a sphere of water that would grab people and pull it into the water so that they're drowning. And I used a gelatinous cube. Mm-hmm. Used that stat block, but just recast as this water element. Instead of the traditional thing, water element, like crashing like a wave and knocking people around, I just like this idea of there's just this sphere of water that you just couldn't escape from. You're just slowly drowning inside of it. And that was actually a really simple conversion. I just sort of changed some of the keywords and just the flavor of the attacks. And I think I added in the ochre jelly, I think, has a thing where when you bloody it, it breaks into two ones. Mm-hmm. And I just added that to it, that as you took damage, it's sort of the magic holding it together starts to weaken and breaks down into two smaller spheres. I also do a lot of my named like villains using this. Like I might just start with a creature and then add a few like key traits on. In my Greyhawk campaign, I use as my big bad guy. He's sort of the campaign menace. And everyone who served IUs has this ability that's they can use it when they're bloodied. They create an illusory duplicate of themselves in their space, turn invisible, then teleport away. And it was nice having that theme. That actually is what led to, I know you guys, the themes that we had in DMG2 and have used a few other places. That's where that idea came from, because the players pretty soon hated fighting guys who were IUs. Because not only that, if you attack the illusionary duplicate, it would turn into a cloud of poisonous gas. So half the time, they've got this guy cornered, and they would jump on him, and they're all choking on poisonous gas, and the guy's 50 feet away and running for cover. And that was a really fun thing. Like all the priests of IUs, all his important lieutenants had that power. And so that was something where I think added a lot of flavor to the world. It kind of made them think, hey, now we know we're fighting a guy who works for IUs. He just did that damn trick we hate. So,
One of the things, I recently ran a campaign in the Feywild, and they were fighting the Prince of Frost and his various minions. And all I did was went on the compendium and did a search for cold in the level range that I wanted. And, you know, I could turn an owlbear into a ladrin just by adding teleport and changing the claws to be a couple of swords. And I mean, sometimes I'll have the stat block in front of me and won't even change anything. I'm just running it off the top of my head. And there's so much that you can do just by the way you describe things.
Yes.
I like the Medusa mechanic for gaze a lot. And it seems like I use that all the time, but I adapt it just by describing it differently. For instance, a creature, like if you're in the room and suddenly it's got all these, you know, tendrils in its head, right? And it's just like shooting them into your brain and it's, you know, leeching your stuff. You can use the exact same mechanic for for the Medusa, but suddenly you're describing it completely differently. People are like, what? What's happening? A tendril's in my head? It's coming, you know, and
Bruce,
that's
like,
the same mechanic.
Stuff.
I did not say tentacle.
Tendril, tentacle, very different. It's like, Bruce has like 500 words for tentacle like us.
It's actually a list on the inside of his computer.
Exactly. Okay, yeah. I use that one in this project. I can't use that one.
One of the things that you mentioned, the Medusa, that I often will do is take, and I did this in the Feywild section, was take the petrify mechanic and use ice instead of stone. Because one might assume that petrified means simply that you turn to stone, but actually the condition says nothing about that. You gain some resistance and...
Yeah, well, it's funny you mentioned, because I had a thing, very similar thing, where instead of petrified, you got turned into water. Mm-hmm. So the water temple, if you look, and you just splash, you're just destroyed. You know, all your gear is and you become part of the temple. You know, that was sort of the sacrificial element to it.
I want to play your campaign.
Yeah, I know.
It's very hot.
Let's see, old school.
But I put the monster builder up there just to mention that we actually just had an update 2 days ago to it that it includes the new monster format. And so... now, you know, you've got all the different monsters, including from Monster Manual 3 on there. Converting some of the older monsters, the format might be a little wonky, but this is a great tool if you have the opportunity to use it, because it does really let you easily reskin things. And if you don't feel like you just want to kind of improvise it, like I was just talking about, this is a really quick way to do it.
I've used this a lot. I like the three-panel version a little bit better with the holding pin. You can drag and drop a lot of things.
Yeah.
I remember the last update I got took out the lookup for different powers, which I like for making my own monsters.
Yeah, it's called a monster builder, but really a more appropriate term I think would be monster editor, because I suspect most people don't actually use this to create monsters from scratch. I think that the best way to use it...
it's the monster templater.
Yeah, is to apply templates or to make, you know, use a theme or something like that.
It's tricky with the digital tool, because the less feature you have, the easier it is for the programmers to focus. So it's kind of it's a double-edged sword trying to cram everything into one place.
Yeah.
So sorry, just want to ask a question. How many people here use this program?
Wow.
Oh wow. Okay. Cool. So it's really one of those more art than science things. You know, I like to think, you know, it's such a tired thing, but you know, a monster should have enough powers. Like, you know, but I generally feel that once you get beyond three or four different things it can do, unless it's like a really important mastermind creature, like, okay, I want this guy to be very versatile, I want the players to fight him a few times, I want him to always have something, a trick up his sleeve, I find like beyond two or three different attacks, you're starting to just kind of like, it's easy to lose track of those. I've actually found a lot of the monsters I make myself, I'll just give them one attack. If it's just a gnoll with an axe, it's got an axe attack, maybe it has like that gnoll effect where if there's two or more creatures, an extra creature, it gets a damage bonus. I like mechanics like that are easy for me to remember across an entire type of creature. I know all gnolls get this. It's easier for me to remember than to think, oh, this one gnoll gets this benefit. So I just really think in terms of the adventure and in terms of the bigger picture, the guys I almost think is like the monster torchbearers. Like these gnolls are just here to attack the PCs and they're not the stars. They shouldn't be. If they're important, it's because of a funky series of dice rolls or something kind of weird happened. You know, like the guy keeps critting, you know, or something like that. I'll go down to one power on those guys, and then I'll kind of add more powers as I think it was dramatically, or just in terms of the ecology and stuff. How important is this creature in terms of the story, in terms of its hierarchy and things like that? So like the Mordred example, probably the lower ranking ones, I just give one power to. A lot of the train effects people talk about, those would be great too, because I can just remember those. I'm not using that on its turn. I just kind of think of those as like a terrain thing that's changing the encounter. And then the more higher end guys, I might start doing like three, four, maybe even five powers, the really tricky, complex guy. But I don't want a bunch of those guys that I'm trying to run at the table, because I'm just going to get overwhelmed. The other thing I really like to do too is I'll make, so in my campaign I had this dwarf assassin the party had to deal with, and I gave him this poison attack, and I just said, hey, okay, when he uses the poison attack, he picks one of these five poisons. And it was nice thing, but it was very versatile. You know, one immobilized, one dazed, one, I think one just did a lot of extra poison damage. And I just said, okay, he gets one use of each of these. He's using the same attack. It's just when I would make the attack, I could say, okay, now which poison do I want to use? It focused my attention a little bit. You know, okay, this guy's a knife thrower. He's just going to stand back and throw knives. And I just found for myself, I don't know, this might not be true for everybody, but it was easier for me to look at one attack and then go, oh, well, how do I want to shade it? Rather than here are four or five different attacks, I need to look at them all and to remember which one does what.
Yeah.
One of the things that I think has become clear, especially with the new stat block format, is that it's very easy to see when a creature kind of hits that critical point. When under the standard actions, it's got like four powers. I mean, most monsters are rarely around even that long.
Yeah.
So that's one. hopefully.
Oh, goodness.
I mean, that is one thing to think about is how long the monster is going to be around. If it's a soldier or brute, it's going to tend to probably be picked on earlier on in the combat, and
yeah.
So it might not need as many powers. Whereas a controller or an artillery, well, artillery is actually a bad example because usually you don't want them to be that complicated. But
yeah.
Something that's a controller or a leader, maybe a skirmisher, might have a few more tricks.
Yeah.
But I agree with Mike that usually like 2 to 3 powers is all most monsters need.
Yeah.
I like to usually have a trait on the monsters if it's a group of monsters.
Yeah, something simple like a sneak attack style mechanic. It has combat advantage, it gets a damage bonus. Just that and a basic attack can make a monster really flavorable. Especially if that number is really big. I've had creatures where the guy's just hitting for 3. I think I had some Kenku I just kind of made up where this 4th level party, they're going to hit for 4, hitting it for 5. Well, these Kenku are hitting for nothing with their daggers. Now it has combat advantage, 38.
Yeah.
Oh man, I shouldn't have made fun of that Kenku. and just things like that makes it very memorable without the players forcing me to do a lot of mechanical work with powers. But it's also a great point too to think like something like a controller, or actually even an artillery who's far back, he might stick around for a while, so maybe you want to have a trick he can throw into the fight itself. Or like the drow, crosswind back there is just plinking away at the characters, and then suddenly, oh wait, he poisons a bolt and hits somebody, and oh, that's something really bad that's just happened. He poisoned. You're stunned, you're transforming into a spider, whatever the weird, gross poison does. But I like the powers that kind of lend themselves being used near the end of the fight, because it's a good way to surprise the players when they think they have everything in the bag, and then there's like a transformation. Question mark here?
Do you have any further tips on protecting elite bosses at Paragon and Epic tier? I have a tendency of dropping the second I put them on the map.
Yeah, so the tough thing, I think the toughest thing from my experience with elites and solos is the players are getting up on them.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the mechanics, some of them are just kind of simple like escape mechanics, like ways to just kind of end conditions, or giving them multiple turns helps, especially with save end stuff because they get multiple saves. And I also generally will, for a lot of my ones I've designed, and we haven't really done this in print, but I've kind of messed with it in my own games, let it say at the end of its next turn, anything that ends at the end of an enemy's turn ends at that point. It's a little hard to make clear, but let's say the paladin slows the elite. You're slowed until the end of my next turn. Well, this guy's mechanic says, after I take my next turn and I get 3 turns around, that's when that effect ends. So the players are still going to get benefit out of it, but it's not posing the entire solo's abilities. I also like solos with in elites that are versatile. They need a good way, like an elite that just beats up on one character can be problematic because the rest of the party doesn't feel threatened. And especially like if they're only really worried about combat advantage or like giving up opportunity attacks, it's easy for the players just to maneuver wherever they want and do whatever they want. So if you have a solo, an elite that may have, trying to think of a good example. If you attack it at range, it can charge you as an immediate reaction. Things like that. It has good ways to end marks. Usually want the mark to be something it has to take an action to do, not just do it for free.
One of the things that I think is can be a problem for elites is that any monster that the players identify as a leader is that they're going to throw all their status effects on it. They're going to put their vulnerability, their daze, their immobilized, whatever. And we've got the bonus to saving throws, but the reality is that most PCs, unless they're using a daily, aren't putting down effects that a save can end on a monster. It's the stuff that lasts until the end of the next turn that's really killing it. I think that what Mike mentioned about it basically dropping the duration by kind of one step, or giving it an automatic saving throw at the start of its turn against each effect, regardless of whether a save can end, might, if you're really having a problem with elites being killed, maybe that's your new elite trait.
Yeah.
You replace the +2 save and throw. It kind of depends on the party, but if you've got really tactical players, which probably if you're at Gen Con, you've got a lot of tactical players.
And the simplest thing, of course, is just to put more elites on the board, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a brute force approach, but it really, it's very effective and it splits the party up and you know, it's maybe the XP value seems out of whack, but
well,
that's the way to go.
A lot of it, I think, has to do with encounter design too, and this is something that's really difficult to frame within a monster itself, because it comes down to how you lay out the monsters. Like, I know that in my group, as soon as the players identify somebody who is the leader, they will go to any lengths to get to that person. I think in my last session, I put like five slats down on the table, and then there was a portal that the bad guy had escaped through, and they basically teleported or slid or got through the slats and left them all behind chasing after this leader, because by the time you're Paragon tier, they have so many tricks up their sleeve that they can do that. So trying to figure out, trying to frame encounters so that maybe the leader's not out right at the start of it. Maybe it has an illusion that's it's a duplicate and they have...
A little misdirection.
Just having a lot of creatures in front of it that are going to be blocking the PC's movement or teleportation as they try to get to that leader is a good way to go.
I want to throw in one more thing too, is having good support creatures. I had in one of my campaigns, the players are fighting, I forget what elite it was, like an elemental or something. It was an evil wizard with it. And one of the things with anything, when you have one creature, it's easy to stack zones up, or like hit it with a zone and mobilize it. So I had this a cleric of, I think it was a cleric of values, he had a power that let him destroy zones. And when he destroyed the zone, he could then throw a buff on an ally, basically stole the magic. So the first time the players are like, okay, we'll throw a web, and then we'll throw a wall of fire on it, and they feel really badass, and then the cleric of Ayu is just, I'll take that magic, and now this guy's at +5 to hit for the next two rounds. You don't want to do that too often, because you don't want to just like undercut the player's abilities, it's kind of cheesy, but forcing them to kind of change your tactics a little bit. Like, for example, like with the elite, if you have a bunch of guys who have get bonus damage with combat advantage, well now the fighter runs up to the elite, and if he has it locked down, well now that combat advantage monster runs into a flank with the fighter and starts hitting for a ton of damage. Now the players have to make a tough choice. Do we keep piling on the elite, or do we take care of the smaller guy who's throwing out a damage off damage, or party might start getting worried about it? I've done this, I don't know how many times I've done this in D&D, where players come across as a bridge, and there's a monster on the other side, fighting the rogue, whoever, go running across the bridge, and the first thing the monster does, like the giant, is pick a rock and smash the bridge. And like, oh, like, rogue's here, and there's 50 feet of water, and then there's the fighter who, you know, put on your little, you know, your water wings of that plate mail and try to swim across. Just things like that, where it's just, oh, okay. Like, so the terrain effects that make things more complicated and make the plan less just A, B, C, and D. Now there's some complications to do that.
I think observing your players is a really good point, that if you've been running enough sessions for the players, you kind of know their tricks. And you said you don't want to counter everything they do, but you can sort of start to predict their strategies and create complications for them. Like you said, if they are throwing down a bunch of zones, then you do something, you come up with an adaptation that at least puts a hitch in that particular encounter. I'm sure everybody will think this is evil of me, but oftentimes if I find that a monster isn't challenging the players, I will give it a new power in the encounter. The thing you have to be careful about, though, is just basically...
You can't let your players realize you're doing that.
Yeah. You can't basically do it just to, like, haha, well, you thought you had immobilized, but this thing is immune to immobilization. I mean, you want to make sure that if you are giving it sort of improvised powers or traits, that they're not just completely...
They're not just nerfing it. They're doing something like Mike, like saying, oh, and they see it, you know, sucking away from it and doing something interesting. So it's not, at least, it's not a net loss for the players. At least they get to see it do something interesting and then, you know, maybe turn that power on them.
Yeah. You know, in that case, it's still wasting an action to do that. You know, maybe you balance it by saying, oh, well, it'll be a standard action. You know, this creature can end all effects on it as a standard action. Then at least the players feel like they got something out of that.
Well, and also kind of part of it comes down to with monsters. Monsters are allowed to think too. Like they can have interesting tactics. A villain can just observe the PCs and learn how to fight them. Early on in one of my campaigns, the party wizard was using Flaming Sphere all the time. And so he throws this Flaming Sphere out in this battle against this wizard on these different, at this very elemental evil themed campaign. He had some air elementals with him, these air guys, and they could slide people around. So the wizard throws out his flaming sphere, and then the air thing goes, and it grabs three or four PCs and throws them next to the flaming sphere. So on their next turns, they'll get roasted by the flaming sphere, you know, things like that. You know, and that's just that was just something which had, was just, you know, the wizard fought PCs before, kind of knew, okay, this is what these guys do. I'm going to summon some creatures to help me deal with them.
One of the things I've taken to doing, particularly in D&D encounters where there's a lot of new players, is the rogue will be like, they'd be like, oh, I can't get combat advantage this round. So I'll say, well, you can get combat advantage, but, and because I'll let them do like an acrobatics check to try, you know, like basically push themselves off the wall and spring around behind the creature or whatever. But providing players ways to interact with, like you were saying, the terrain or the monsters in interesting ways, but giving them risks. Even if the monster doesn't necessarily, let's say they're trying to like get to the other side of it. Even if the monster doesn't normally let things move through its space, if it's a huge creature, you can say, yeah, sure, you can tumble under it, but you might get hit.
Yeah. I had a similar situation. The players are fighting this guy on a castle wall. I forget if it was like a lich or something. He had his back to the edge of the wall, and the rogue wanted to get into a flank. So I said, okay, you get into a flank. If you jump off the edge, I'll let you make the attack on your way down. And it's like, well, is he bloodied? I'm like, yeah, he's been hit pretty hard. Okay, I'll do it. And he killed it. He jumped by, stabbed it, and then fell off the edge. It was one of those moments where the players really, everyone was like, oh, what, I hope he does this, because if he falls, we're screwed.
Real moment of greatness.
But to kind of bring this back around to monsters, what I think is you should take from this is that you don't need to necessarily use what's on the stat block. That the PCs should have, as long as they're interacting with the monster in an interesting way, you should feel at liberty to improvise, and you should let your players improvise as well. It's really easy to fall into the mentality that, well, my powers are the only things I can do.
Yeah.
And both for monsters and PCs. But that's not true. That you can still use skill checks in any way, you know, the player wants, you know, as long as it's balanced, and you know that you give them that you're making sure that it makes sense in the story.
Yeah.
So like sometimes even like the miniature maybe has a really cool art on it that gives you inspiration. Last night the rogue wanted to jump on the back of the Nerevon, did so, and the DM's like, fine, but one of the dead bodies on the Nerevon is now grabbed you.
Oh, cool.
It grabs the table line, reached out and grabbed the rogue, and he's like, oh crap, and now he was restrained, and he had to try and break away from this.
Yeah, I remember another D&D encounter story is that we were fighting the Kanks. I was running a session, and basically the players wanted to taint. No, it wasn't the Kanks. Well, whatever. It was one of the players actually wanted to tame the Kank. And you know, this creature was fighting them, and there was nothing in the stat block that said that they could, you know, when it's bloody, you can make a nature check to try to tame the creature. But that's more interesting, you know, creates interesting situations, and to make sure to be open that as you're running your monsters.
But really, it's story driven. I just kind of think like in the cosmos of D&D, is this a creature that threatens a village? Is it a creature that threatens a city? Is it a creature that threatens a plane? Is it a creature that threatens the cosmic order? The Nerevon are a good example where those, when they came into Monster Hunter 3, it was like, okay, what's their story? These guys want to, they basically want to destroy the cosmos. They're an epic tier threat. Something like a Modron, you might say, drawing that example, do we want these guys to be just an epic tier? Do you want them to be across all tiers? If they're across all tiers, how do they work together? And that might be something where we say, okay, yeah, we kind of like the idea of these guys being a local threat. They're heroic tier. And there might be Paragon and epic tier versions, entire groups of them. But we want, from low levels, you to interact with these guys. Yeah, it's a lot of it's just in general looking at what the characters can do in that level. My kind of rule of thumb is you kind of want the players to have like one way to escape, but not, you know, infinite ways to escape. So a good example would be like slow. Slow can be irritating, but it's probably not going to be a life or death matter for a PC in most situations. Immobilize, though, if you immobilize a guy who's next to a bunch of swarms, he can get really hosed pretty quickly. So I might, at low levels, do a mobilize as like an encounter power or a recharge power. But at higher levels, now that I have more cleric abilities to like give out saves, more ways for other party members to move other party members around, maybe I start using it as part of an at-will attack and things like that. So there's definitely a line between stuff like slow and like small amounts of force movement and things like immobilize or really high ongoing damage values that start saying, okay, to really deal with this, the party needs to start using other spells and powers and stuff to get around it. So that's when at higher levels you see that stuff start to come into more and more often. There are a few just game, like things you just try not to do. Like we try not to put a stun in an at-will power just because it gets this sort of like, okay, you go, I lose my turn. You go, I lose my turn. You just, the monster's just canceling a character out. So we try to keep those in a like an encounter power or a special trigger thing. Anything that causes the players to lose their turns. The daze is a little bit similar, but I think that gets used a little, that obviously gets used at lower levels a little bit more often. But it really just comes down to the magnitude of the effect. Like, how much is this going to screw up a character? You know, damage being the lowest rank of that, because you have your hit points to absorb it, and then all the different conditions that deny you actions, or they, like an unconscious power. It's very rare that we put any creature that just has an attack to make you unconscious. The Jackalware in MM3, I actually saw a couple threads online about that, where people are like, wow, this Jackalware with its gaze can just put you out if it hits you, you know? And that was kind of intentional, because it's a very... There's only one of the Jackalwares can do that, the more powerful one. But that was kind of intentional to kind of capture that, the feel of the Jackalware's classic story, and to kind of give these guys, like, this is what makes them really scary. If you're fighting a Jackalware, watch out, don't look into its eyes. One of them might have a gaze attack that can just knock you out in one shot.
Of course, once it does that once, then the players kill it the next round, because they all swarm and So, yeah, we've already kind of been answering a lot of questions, but we can just definitely move into the questions portion of the discussion. So if anybody has any other questions that they want to ask, feel free to. So are there any other questions about monster design? Do you guys, any challenges you've faced with your own design or with, you? It sounds like most of you are DMs that we've talked a little bit about how to challenge the party.
There is a very fine line between making the monster hard to hit and making the monster impossible to hit. Of course, to some extent, players can try and modify that by putting conditions on the monster or getting flanking. But kind of how Greg was saying before, when he improvises sometimes, that is one place I will improvise. If I'm just finding that my players are just, for whatever reason, they can't get into the situation where they can hit the monster, I'll be like, I think this monster has this monster is not 25 AC, it's 23 AC. And I'll just move forward from that point. So, at some point, you have to recognize, I think, if, as the DM, probably a good idea to recognize no players is hitting this monster. It has a lower the armor class on the fly.
Yeah. It's the main thing to watch out towards when you're using monsters that are above the party's level. Just watch out if you're using soldiers, because they have a high AC for their level. So it's just one combo to watch out for. Or any creature that has just a persistent attack penalty standing out, like a zone. Like Bruce said, kind of watch the line between this is hard and this is just something where the PCs just can't hit with their attacks.
One thing I often do in the middle of a session is I'll actually ask the player what they rolled, like, because I want to know that if they are kind of hitting between fives and 15s, that there's sort of a range there, and those are sort of the extremes. Most of the time, players are hitting on sevens, eights in my group, but. If I find that a player, if I ask a player, what did you roll? And they say, I rolled a 14 or a 15. That's kind of telling me that maybe that monster's has a little too high defenses, and I'll often bump them down. If you're kind of concerned about breaking the suspension of disbelief, you can always have, improvise a power. If somebody scores a critical hit against it, when you do that, you give it a minus 3 penalty to defenses, or when it's bloodied, suddenly its defenses go down. That might not happen on the monster, but you can create powers that still give the illusion that give the illusion to the players, but are going to ultimately make the encounter much easier.
What would be the place where you think you would start to try to build a creature that wasn't really, you have an idea for, but you don't know how strong you want to make him, what level,
yeah.
That sort of thing.
I mean, if you already have an idea of like what some of the powers is going to have, like I kind of picture in my mind, like movie of the monster fighting, what is it doing? The next thing is I kind of think, as far as level, like, well, what levels do I think the campaign is going to span? Is this campaign going to end around 10? Is it going to end around 20? Where are my players right now? How tough are this guy? I kind of think almost like, when this guy is a memory, what level should the characters be?
Yeah.
You know, so at what point are they going to defeat him and go on to the next quest? And that kind of helps me story-wise determine where I want to put a guy as far as his level goes. So you might think, like, what you described, maybe he's like five levels lower than the big main villain, so that gives the players a chance to defeat him and then turn to the next quest. Yeah.
Or if you're worried about your villain scaling, you can always have them kill the villain, and then he turns out to be a lich or undead, or the bad guys revive him, other bad guys revive him. There are a lot of ways that, you know, a lot of tricks you can use to sort of have your bad guys scale with the players. You know, maybe it's a doppelganger pretending to be the bad guy when the real bad guy is acting from the shadows or whatever. There's, I think when you are designing monsters or picking monsters for an adventure, even though you want the level to be representative of the monster, you also have to be kind of practical. You know, the players are playing a game, and you don't get preoccupied with, oh, well, this guy really needs to be level 20 because that's how you see it in the world. You know, if the players are level 10 then and they're going to be fighting this guy, then make him level 10.
Yeah.
Don't get too, you know, concerned with trying to be true to the world and then forget that the players still need to have fun playing the game.
Yeah. Anything that you want, like, yeah, and I think that's true. Like, you kind of want to mix the two. Like, is this guy really as tough as, like, Asmodeus? You know? Okay, he doesn't need to be level 30, right? He could be, like, you know. And like I said before, like, think of the tone of your campaign. If your campaign is very much firmly lodged in the heroic tier, right? You don't plan on going to the planes. Like, my Greyhawk campaign, once the players reach level 10, I'll probably end the campaign. That'll end that story arc. I don't plan on this campaign being the campaign where they kill Ayus. They're just more fighting against his minions. They already hate his minions enough that once if they kill those guys, they'll be satisfied, and that's a good end of the campaign, then we'll start the next one.
So. Just sitting here listening to everyone around the room going through a Modron, I guess we can all kind of fall in love with the things we're creating, the monsters we're creating. And it's, you know, I've sort of imported some monsters from a video game. Me and all my friends, we've played this old video game for a while. It's very D&D-like, so we decided to make a jump. And just doing it, I've kind of fallen in love with a couple of them. And because we all know it, and I trust my guys not to take, you know, out-of-game stuff into the real game, we've done some playtesting. It's helped me, you know, change some things around. But, I mean, how do you get around that? I mean, obviously, not everyone can playtest with their players. They're, you know, all of a sudden, it's not fun for your players because they helped you do this. I mean, is there more of a rule of thumb when you're creating something, you limit the number of powers per tier just to make sure that you don't add so much stuff in? It's just crazy.
The part of the biggest piece of advice I give for a DM running your campaign is I think of every session as almost a playtest. Like, I've definitely had my Greyhawk campaign iterations of, I've tried using this creature and this is how it worked out. So now I know, based on how that worked, like the thing with the wizard destroying the zones, that was based on earlier combats with the players using a lot of zones to shut down monsters and control the battlefield. It's like, okay, I kind of want to start, like, here's a guy who would have been really interesting. He got shut down by the wall of fire. Okay, that's fine. Like, the players won. But now I want to think for the next challenge, it goes back to, like, watching your players and see what's going on with the creatures you built. Each encounter informing the next one, or each adventure informing the next one.
I never thought about it. I've pre-built all the characters, and I never thought I could just evolve them along with the game.
Exactly. And the way I think, especially with intelligent villains, it's just in the world, the villain is just adapting his tactics. He's learning new tricks. You know, like the guy who brought along the air elementals to knock around the party. He just fought the guys before, knew about them, and said, okay, this is what these guys do. I've got to get ready to, just like the players do. The players know, hey, we're fighting a dragon, so we want, you know, energy resistance. You know, it's a red dragon. We need fire resistance. We need something to deal with in a really big solo. So either magic items are buying or how they're thinking of their feats, the players are probably adapting their tactics, and really the DM is just doing this the same on their side of the DM screen.
So the blog I wrote, the preamble is that I don't actually use experience in my game, but I do understand that a lot of people adhere very strictly to XP budgets, making sure you're to follow the guidelines in the DMG. But if you're doing that, it can actually create a bit of a problem because that's sort of a closed system. It doesn't look at the fact that you might have power gamers in your group, or you might have a group full of strikers or whatever. And those are good things that are going to actually influence the difficulty of an encounter, regardless of whether you're following the XP budget or not. So I find that things like that particularly true with traps and minions, they may not represent as much of a threat to different types of groups. That certain, you know, the if you might throw 10 minions against a group with a really good controller, you know, somebody who has fireball and the enlarge spell, or enlarge. Anyway, something to expand the size so that you've got an area burst 4 that just wipes out half the minions in the first round. Well, those minions technically represented 2 monsters worth of creatures, but there's no monster that's typically going to die, or no 2 monsters that could be killed that fast. So if what it comes down to, I think, is giving out, if you are going to give out XP, you really should allow yourself some give with, you should allow yourself to give more or less experience based on the challenge. That if the players are really good at wiping out minions, you want to occasionally throw a bunch of minions at them and so that they can have fun with their spells and whatever, but you know that that's not quite as much of a challenge for them as if you throw like 2 elite brutes or something.
Yeah. You just look at the reality situation, you know, just like in, you know, the, you know, if you're walking in the hallway and you saw someone run by and push someone over as they're running so fast, they think, what a jerk. And if it turns out, oh, they're running to call 911 because someone's having a heart attack, okay, that explains that situation. I mean, that's a pretty extreme example, but in this, like, the minions, yeah, but as it turned out, they weren't a challenge. They didn't make the encounter any harder. I'm not really going to count their XP toward, because it wasn't a challenge.
I think there's few things more satisfying as a player to have something that you acquired or some trick you learned in the past come back a few sessions later and reward you for that. Often the players are going to think, well, I was so clever because 2 sessions ago I went and found this item, when the reality is that you as the DM might actually be planting that there for them. But it's a very rewarding experience for them. And so if you are in a situation where you can plan out your monsters or your encounters several sessions in advance, that's a great idea to seed advantages in those early encounters that can then balance harder encounters down the line.
Yeah, like one of the things, the trick I use with the guys who follow, I use to create the illusory double, I let the players, if it's a minor action, they make a perception check to see if it's actually an illusion, and they learn to do that. And that's what made that kind of fun. The players felt like, oh, we're getting smarter. Like, here's a trick we learned, or now we know how to foil this, you know. And sometimes they miss their checks, sometimes they don't. But it was something that helped drive players feeling like they're part of the world, they're understanding the setting, they're acquiring knowledge of tactics and growing. So one of the nice things about this approach to monster design is instead of having everything very grounded primarily in realism and a sort of a few abilities that like improved grab in third edition, which was used again and again and again, one of the advantages we have of having a more open system, a more what they call exceptions-based system, where every rule kind of breaks the rules in some way, is it essentially opens up the playground for us. If you look at Monster Manual 1, 2, and 3, you can see how some of the design is changing, but it lets us, if we make up a, like the NERA, we can come up with a complete new subsystem you've never seen before. It's driven by powers. It ties those guys together and reflects, like, you know, pun intended, their mirror magic, things like that. Where we can create, here's an entire new tribe of orcs, you know, and I had a campaign with these orcs who worship elemental fire, and they have these fire-based powers. When you kill them, they exploded. Their shamans could, you know, if an orc died, the shaman could make the orc spirit rise as a fire creature. We don't have to worry about, like, creating spells and player stuff to fuel that. We could just create it in its own area and let it be its own thing. So that's something where it really opens up where we can go with the monsters, and we can just keep pushing new frontiers and really let the story, the elements of the world, drive design, and not this sort of like, well, here are the 10 mechanics we have, and here are the feats, and here are the spells, we have to work within these. It really opens that up. So I hope the answer is never. I mean, one of the things that I remember hearing this, like when Magic first came out in 1993, there was a sense like in about 96 or so, have we reached the end? Can we make any more cards? And 14 years later, they're still doing it.
Well, and that's one of the reasons that in the presentation we sort of started with the story idea, because it shows that you don't actually need to start with, okay, well, I want my power to immobilize and do fire damage, or whatever. that you start with the story, as long as you're starting with the story, there is no limit as long as you can continue to be creative.
Right, and Magic is an exception-based game design, and look how long that's going along. And now our game is an exception-based game design, so we can go along as well. And something we were saying before, as long as you can take disparate elements, you were talking about the Minotaur and the Labyrinth, I mean, we can continue to do that ad infinitum. We can always link and have insights to things that are unconnected and suddenly make a new story. And then the new story suddenly has us a whole new suite of powers that work together in a particular way that makes sense within the context of that story and makes it a new interesting story for the players.
Yeah.
No. There is a progression moving forward.
Yeah. I mean, certainly, if you look at monsters from Monster Manual 3, there's a lot more monsters now that sort of have automatic effects. They're marking you even if they're not hitting you. And that's because we've recognized that need in the game. And so even as we continue to push the boundaries of story, we're also evolving the mechanics. And undoubtedly, you know, in another few years, we'll know even more about how to make monsters interesting.
So I don't want to bring up the essentials, so I don't want to turn this into an essentials QA. But one of the things, if you look at the essentials, where we're not releasing a new edition of the game, same rules, but we're making character classes that feel very different. Because now that we have an exceptions-based game, I can take the player's handbook one fighter, which is very driven by his powers, I can create a new fighter who's driven by basic attacks and stances, and they use the same exact rule system, and they sit alongside each other. It's just this is one build, and this is a different build. And I have a lot more design space to play with. I don't need to go back and change the core rules of the game, make you guys buy a new edition or whatever. Instead, I can just keep working within the space I've already built. I don't have to break. It's like the difference between building a house and sort of like, I can't think of a good example of it, but it's like, I don't have to knock down a wall to add an addition. I can just put an addition right next to it, and I've already built the little space where I'll stick my doorway to connect them all. Yeah, I don't need to redo the entire structure to add.
To take Mike's analogy of the house, I think, you know, the math is the foundation, but that's not actually, you know, that's not what you see. It's the house that you build on that foundation, and that's the story.
And if anything, it's so I'm going to beat this analogy to death. The foundation just doesn't limit you. It expands more. I don't want to say it's more like...
It actually might be rude.
Like, it's almost more like it's the timbers choosing to build your house. You build the frame, and then you add the actual element. People don't care. Like, my house, when I went to buy it, I didn't care that there was, like, wood inside of it. I cared what the rooms looked like, and what was the carpet like, and the painting, and what we do to change it. That's the important part. But, of course, I want rotten wood, you know, frames. My house falls over, you know. But... that's important, but it's not the point. The point is, what is it when you're at the table, the story, the monster, what's happening in the game? Cool.
Any other questions?
Yeah. You guys have any questions? That was a great audience. Thanks very much. Good questions.
Thank you very much.